This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, March 28, 2024. Immigration and Customs Enforcement announces the arrest of over 200 non-U.S. citizens for drug-related crimes. Census Bureau revises for the first time in decades how it categorizes people by race and ethnicity. We'll talk about it with NPR correspondent Hansi Lo Wang. Former President Donald Trump, a Republican presidential candidate, attends the wake of a murdered New York City police officer, calling for more law and order. Salvage operations begin in Baltimore at the bridge that collapsed after being hit by a container ship. U.S. State Department is disappointed, it says, in Russia's veto of a United Nations Security Council resolution to extend North Korean sanctions monitoring. We remember the late Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, who has died at the age of 82. And the new owner of the Baltimore Orioles, billionaire David Rubenstein, speaks to the fans on this opening day of the Major League Baseball season, saying he hopes to unite the city and win a World Series again. Headline at ABC News, ICE arrests 216 unauthorized migrants in nationwide drug crackdown. The subhead, the non-citizens from 28 countries were apprehended for various crimes, including drug possession and drug trafficking, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement announced. The ICE Acting Deputy Director, P.J. Lechtleitner, held a news conference today at ICE headquarters in Washington.
Today, I'm very pleased to announce the results of a 12-day ERO operation targeting non-citizens who have been convicted of either drug trafficking offenses or multiple drug possession offenses involving methamphetamine, fentanyl, cocaine, heroin, or synthetic drugs. Many of the people arrested during this operation have final orders of removal, which means that once they're in ERO custody, we can remove them to their home countries. This significant nationwide operation ran from March 11 through March 22, covering 25 areas of operation across the U.S., from Boston to Seattle, including our nation's capital right here. This operation enabled us to do what ERO was created to do, and that is focus on smart, effective immigration enforcement to protect our homeland by arresting and removing people who undermine public safety and violate the integrity of our immigration laws. The ICE National Criminal Analysis and Targeting Center identified 419 non-citizens who are subject to law enforcement action during this operation. Some of the people we arrested include a 44-year-old citizen of Mexico who was arrested in New Jersey and was convicted of money laundering, narcotics conspiracy, felony distribution and possession with intent to distribute heroin, and possession or use of a firearm in relation to drug trafficking. We also arrested a 34-year-old citizen of El Salvador in Cincinnati who was convicted of felony conspiracy to possess with the intent to distribute fentanyl. And in Orlando, ERO officers arrested a 32-year-old citizen of India who was convicted of trafficking oxycodone and felony possession of a controlled substance with intent to sell or deliver. Again, this operation resulted in a total of 216 arrests, pretty significant, all connected to the terrible drug epidemic that's sweeping our country.
ICE Acting Deputy Director P.J. Lechtleitner at a news conference in Washington. Story from CBS, House Republicans are set to present the articles of impeachment against Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate after Congress returns from recess next month, kickstarting a clash over an impeachment trial in the upper chamber that Democrats are expected to work to quickly squash. Speaker Mike Johnson and the House impeachment managers wrote in a letter to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on Thursday that they intend to present the Senate with the impeachment articles on Wednesday, April 10th, after both chambers returned from a two-week break. Johnson said in a statement, if he cares about the Constitution and ending the devastation caused by Biden's border catastrophe, Senator Schumer will quickly schedule a full public trial and hear the arguments put forth by our impeachment managers. That reporting from CBS News. The Office of Management and Budget today has issued updated standards for the Census Bureau's maintaining, collecting, and presenting race and ethnicity data. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR correspondent who covers the census, joins us now to talk about it. Thanks for being with us. What are these changes?
So there are two big changes. The first one is a new checkbox for Middle Eastern or North African, and that's related to a change to the federal government's definition of the white racial category. We'll no longer include groups like Egyptian, Iranian, Israeli, Kurdish, Lebanese, Palestinian, and Syrian. That's because there's been research suggesting that many people today with roots in the Middle East or North Africa do not see themselves as white. And the other major change gets at, you know, the confusion that a lot of Latinos experience when they try to answer the census. You know, there's a growing number of Latinos who consider both their ethnicity and their race to be Latino. But right now, federal forms are required to ask about a person's Latino identity separate from their racial identity. That's because the federal government considers Latino to be an ethnicity that can be of any race. And what the change is that there's going to be a combined question that asks, what is your race and or ethnicity? And instructions to select all the checkboxes that apply.
And why were the changes made?
Well, this is part of a review the White House's Office Management and Budget says to make sure that the government's statistics about race and ethnicity reflect how people identify today. You know, the last time these statistical standards that a lot of people probably haven't heard about, but are the things that the policy that undergirds the Census Bureau statistics, federal, all the other federal government statistics, these standards haven't been updated since 1997, which is now more than a quarter century ago. And certainly how people in the United States think about race, ethnicity, think about their identities has changed as it has over the centuries. And so this is part of that review that was started during the Obama administration. It was stalled during the Trump administration. And so there's expectation that we would have seen some of these changes by the 2020 census. Didn't happen. And now the Biden administration has revived them and now announced them and really set them on the path to have some major changes happening on the 2030 census. And before we get to there, some, you know, other federal forms will likely see those changes happening before 2030.
Is today's announcement the final step, or could Congress still weigh in?
Well, this is a decision that is made by the White House's Office Management and Budget, which sets these statistical standards. And as far as I know, there is no stated role of Congress. Of course, there could certainly be new laws, new bills introduced, passed that would force the Census Bureau to do certain things, start not collect information about certain things, to start collecting it, stop collecting it. That has certainly happened, but that's something to watch out for. But as far as I can tell right now, what the next steps are for the federal agencies, including the Census Bureau, to review these new policy changes and to get their forms, to get their databases in line with all these different changes. They have until next September 2025, to come up with a public action plan and ultimately to have all their surveys and data sets ready to go in line with these new standards by 2029.
Finally, how is race and ethnicity data used by the government?
Well, this is data that really is part of this hidden infrastructure in a lot of ways that, you know, these are statistics that maybe a lot of people don't think about, but they're used to, for example, redraw maps of voting districts around the country. They're used to enforce civil rights protections. They're also used for policymaking and for research, you know, to figure out when there are disparities between different populations. This is the data that helps researchers, policymakers figure that out in terms of healthcare outcomes, in terms of educational outcomes. This is the way to figure out whether some groups need more support or more resources, are facing discrimination, and there needs to be some remedy for it.
Hansi Lo Wang, National Public Radio correspondent who covers the census. You can follow him on X at Hansi Lo Wang. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
From NBC News 4 in New York, hundreds of family, friends, and colleagues are expected to attend the first of a two-day wake Thursday for NYPD officer Jonathan Diller, a decorated member of the department who was shot and killed during a Queens traffic stop earlier this week. Mayor Eric Adams, along with former President Donald Trump, are expected to be among those in attendance at Massapequa Funeral Home on Long Island. Later in the afternoon, a funeral mass for the 31-year-old Diller, a three-year NYPD veteran and new father, will be held Saturday at St. Rose of Lima Catholic Church. That was from NBC News 4 earlier today. In a social media post on Tuesday, Donald Trump noted that police said that Diller's alleged shooter, Guy Rivera, had numerous prior arrests, declaring that he never should have been let back out on the street. Today, Donald Trump, a Republican presidential candidate, spoke to reporters at that wake. He was joined by the Nassau County executive, Bruce Blakeman.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. I want to thank Bruce and all of the people that have worked so hard to make this area beautiful and safe. And this is what happened, is such a sad event, such a horrible thing. And it's happening all too often. And we're just not going to let it happen. We just can't. 21 times arrested this thug. And the person in the car with him was arrested many times. And they don't learn because they don't respect. They're not given the respect. The police are the greatest people we have. There's nothing and there's nobody like them. And this should never happen. I just visited with a very beautiful wife that now doesn't have her husband. Stephanie was just incredible. Their child, brand new, beautiful baby, sitting there, innocent as can be, and doesn't know how his life has been changed. But the Diller family will, you'll never be the same. You can never be the same. And we have to stop it. We have to stop it. We have to get back to law and order. We have to do a lot of things differently because this is not working. This is happening too often. It's an honor to be here. And again, I want to just thank all of you folks for allowing this. And Bruce, thank you. Bruce has been a friend of mine for a long time. He's done an incredible job out here. But this is such a sad occasion. The only thing we can say is maybe something is going to be learned. We've got to toughen it up. We've got to strengthen it up. This should never be allowed. Things like this shouldn't take place and to take place so often. So thank you all for being here. It's an honor, and it's an honor for me to be here. This is a great family, the Diller family. I met the friends, and I met every one of them inside, and these are just incredible people that are just devastated. They're devastated. They've got a tough road. It's going to be a very tough road. So thank you very much, everybody. Appreciate it. Thank you, Bruce. Thank you very much.
I just want to say thank you to President Trump for coming here to be with the Diller family. It was very comforting for them. It was very warm inside, and people were very, very, they were very blessed to have someone like President Trump who cared so much, spent a lot of time with the family, and was, again, a tremendous comfort to the family and probably the most difficult time this family's ever had. May God bless Stephanie. Ryan, we are going to help raise, because he's only 1 year old and he's going to grow up without a dad, but he's going to have thousands of dads that are going to look after him. And to Fran, his mother, and to Jennifer and Jason, his brother and sister, and the whole family, Aunt Carol, Uncle Jimmy, our hearts go out to them. And may God bless them and may God bless America. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Got to toughen it up. We got to have law and order. These things can't happen. We need law and order. It just can't happen. Thank you very much.
What changes did you make something like that?
Former President Donald Trump, a Republican presidential candidate this year, along with Bruce Blakeman, Nassau County executive in Massapequa, New York. White House putting out a statement. President Biden spoke to Mayor Adams and gave his condolences about the tragic killing of Officer Jonathan Diller. The president offered Mayor Adams, the city of New York, and the New York Police Department his support in the wake of the tragedy. President Biden flew to New York today, and on the way up on Air Force One, the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre answered a reporter's question about this.
President Biden will be in New York City for most of the day doing fundraising
former President Donald Trump is going to the wake of the NYPD officer. I wondered if you mentioned that the president spoke to Mayor Adams. I wonder if he'd spoke to the family of the officer. And also, you know, Trump is blaming a lot of crime on Biden. I just wondered if you could speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I don't have any private communications to share at this time. Our hearts go out, obviously, to the officer's family and the broader NYPD family who have tragically lost one of their own. The president grieves for them and honors their sacrifice. Look, the president has stood with law enforcement his entire career and continues to stand with them as they put their lives on the line for their communities. Under his leadership, we'll continue to support police officers and ensure that they have resources they need to continue to do the work, the all-important work that they have to do on behalf of the community. Look, violent crime, and I'm just going to be really clear about here, I'm going to be careful about saying anything about 2024, but violent crime surged under the previous administration, which repeatedly attempted to cut the COPS program. All of their budgets targeted that key funding for the police, and congressional Republicans just proposed doing it again. So this is a president, this is a Biden-Harris administration, have done the polar opposite, taking decisive action from the very beginning to fund the police and achieving a historic reduction in crime under his leadership. And so we're going to continue to do that. One more thing I want to say, that the funding, because the president's budget also proposes to fund the police and with billions, so the federal, state, and local government can hire more than 100,000 more officers. And I think that's important to note as well.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre holding a news conference on Air Force One, and President Joe Biden spending the day in New York City, including that campaign fundraiser with former President Barack Obama and former President Bill Clinton. The Biden campaign estimates it will raise $25 million. Former Democratic presidential nominee and former Secretary of State and former Senator, former First Lady Hillary Clinton hosted a forum today about artificial intelligence and elections in the U.S. and around the world. It was at Columbia University's Institute of Global Politics in New York City. Hillary Clinton is a professor of international and public affairs at Columbia. A preview reads, with billions heading to the polls this year, the stakes for global democracies are substantial. Generative AI advances and broad accessibility are already shaping sectors with exponential growth expected to continue. How will these tools change the information ecosystem? And how will governments, campaigns, and the public respond to new challenges? One of the speakers today, former Homeland Security Secretary in the George W. Bush administration, Michael Chertoff.
I would actually argue that this year we're facing something that, in my view, is even more dangerous. And that is, it will be an effort to discredit the entire system of elections and democracy. You know, we had a defeated candidate, who I won't mention their name, who has talked about a rigged election. Now imagine that for the people who are an audience for that, they will start to see videos or audios that look like they're persuasively examples of rigged elections. Now it's like pouring gasoline on a fire, and we could have another January 6th. And I understand that the reason our adversaries like this is because more than anything else, they want to undermine our unity of effort and our democracy. And in a world in which we can't trust anything and we can't believe in truth, we can't have a democracy. And that's, I think, going to lead to a third consequence, which will be very dangerous. We're talking about how do you distinguish and teach people to distinguish deep fakes from real things. And the idea being we don't want to have them misled by the deep fakes. But I worry about the reverse. In a world in which people have been told about deep fakes, do they say everything's a deep fake? Therefore, even real evidence of bad behavior has to be dismissed. And then that really gives a license to autocrats and corrupt government leaders to do whatever they want. So how do we help counteract that? Well, I mean, there's some technological tools. For example, there is now an effort to do watermarking of video and audio, where genuine video or audio, when it's created, has an encrypted mark such that anybody who looks at it can validate that it is real and it's not fake. More than that, we've got to teach people about critical thinking and evaluation so they can cross-check, that when you get a story that appears to stand alone, look to see What are the other stories? Is anybody else picking it up? And we need to actually establish trusted voices that are deliberately very careful and very scientific about the way they validate and test things. And finally, I think we've got to teach, even in the schools, and this is going to start with kids, critical thinking and values, what it is that we care about, and why truth matters, why honor matters, why ethics matters, and then to have them bring that into the way they read and look at things that occur online.
Michael Chertoff was Homeland Security Secretary 2005 through 9, taking part in today's forum at Columbia University's Institute for Global Politics about AI and elections. Another speaker there was the Michigan Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson. We covered it on C-SPAN, and you can find the video at cspan.org. On Wall Street today, the Dow up 47, NASDAQ down 20, S&P up 5. Some Associated Press articles. The number of Americans signing up for unemployment benefits fell slightly last week, another sign that the labor market remains strong and most workers enjoy extraordinary job security. Jobless claims dipped by 2,000 to 210,000, the Labor Department reported Thursday. The four-week average of claims, which smooths out week-to-week ups and downs, fell by 750 to 211,000. And crypto entrepreneur Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced Thursday to 25 years in prison for a massive fraud on hundreds of thousands of customers that unraveled with the collapse of FTX, once one of the world's most popular platforms for exchanging digital currency. An update now on the bridge collapse in Baltimore. This from Washington Post. Maryland will have access to federal money in a matter of days to pay for the start of the Francis Scott Key Bridge recovery and rebuilding mission. But longer-term funding from Congress could take months to arrive, Senator Chris Van Hollen, Democrat from Maryland, told the Washington Post on Thursday. So on Thursday, the state requested the initial payment of $60 million for early recovery and cleanup. Tom Perez is a senior advisor and assistant to President Biden. He's director of the White House Office of Intergovernmental Affairs. He was interviewed today on MSNBC about the recovery efforts and also the six Latino immigrant construction workers who were killed in the disaster.
Yeah, the most fundamental right any worker has when they go to work is to come home safe and sound. And they didn't. And I didn't sleep well last night, and my issues pale in comparison to what they are going through. One person kept saying, one spouse kept saying, solamente quiero el cuerpo. I just want his body, and I understand that. And so does the president. The president instructed us from the moment we learned about this roughly 48 hours ago to move heaven and earth to help everyone. And our first job here is the search and recovery. And as your reporting correctly noted, yesterday was a horrible weather day, and today isn't much better. And notwithstanding that, those first responders were there. They were able to remove and identify two of the bodies, but we still wait for the remaining four. We are moving heaven and earth. There's a heavy lane, a heavy lift crane vessel that will be there later today to help with the debris. But we're also incredibly sensitive to the notion that this is also the resting place for four fathers, for four brothers, for four sons. And so the humanity of the moment is still something very much on Governor Moore's mind, and he's been doing a great job, and President Biden and all our local partners in Baltimore County and Baltimore City.
Tom Perez, senior White House advisor, interviewed today on MSNBC. President Biden has said that he expects the federal government will pay to rebuild the bridge in Baltimore. Today, Congressman Dan Muser, Republican of Pennsylvania, said in a Fox News Channel interview that he does not support that.
It was kind of outrageous immediately for Biden to express in this tragedy the idea that he's going to use federal funds to pay for it in entirety. I mean, he doesn't refer to it as the American taxpayer dollars on anything. You know, the first reaction, in fact, the only reaction, just tends to be to spend. Look, this was a tragedy. We all saw it. People lost their lives, and it is a very important port. As you just mentioned a little while ago, a lot of Pennsylvania's coal is shipped out of there, 25%, automobiles, natural gas. So it needs to be corrected. But, you know, this is a Singapore flagship, number one. So what responsibility are they going to have? At least Janet Yellen is thinking a little bit out of the box rather than just spend the taxpayers' money and see what insurance funding that there would be. And we got to get on that. We just can't take the easy route all the time and just try to spend the taxpayers' money. And something else I'll add, on that T&I bill last year, there was $400 billion in excess. I mean, that's why I didn't vote for it. You know, $900 billion was one thing. $1.25 was another, $350 billion extra. And Maryland, by the way, got almost $5 billion in addition to its standard T&I funding. So, you know, they've got the money.
Congressman Dan Muser, Republican from Pennsylvania, today on Fox News Channel. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan from C-SPAN, along with my colleague, Ben. Since C-SPAN's founding 45 years ago, the media world has changed. Remember when there were just a few TV channels? Now we've got streaming, social media, apps, and more.
Through all of this, C-SPAN has stayed true to its mission of giving you unfiltered access to government wherever you get your news. As we navigate this challenging media environment with fewer people subscribing to traditional cable packages, our funding has been impacted.
That's why we're asking for your help to keep going strong for another 45 years. Please donate today at cspan.org/donate. Your contribution, large or small, helps ensure at least another 45 years of witnessing democracy in action.
Keep C-SPAN thriving in today's ever-changing media landscape. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your gift today. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcast and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. Russia vetoed a UN resolution Thursday in a move that effectively abolishes the monitoring by United Nations experts of UN sanctions against North Korea aimed at reining in its nuclear program, writes the Washington Post, though the sanctions themselves remain in place. Russia's vote sparked Western accusations that Moscow was acting to shield its weapons purchases from North Korea for use in its war against Ukraine, which violate UN sanctions. The vote in the 15-member council was 13 in favor, Russia against, and China abstaining. The Security Council resolution would have extended the mandate of the panel of experts for a year, but Russia's veto will halt its operation when its current mandate expires at the end of April, reporting by the Washington Post. The State Department spokesperson, Matthew Miller, began his news conference in Washington on this.
The United States is deeply disappointed by Russia's veto of the United Nations Security Council's 1718 Committee Panel of Experts mandate renewal. We are also disappointed that the People's Republic of China decided to abstain after 14 years of supporting this important mandate. For the past 15 years, the 1718 Committee Panel of Experts has been the gold standard for providing fact-based, independent analysis and recommendations on the implementation of UN sanctions on the DPRK. Throughout those 15 years, the panel of experts enjoyed the Security Council's unanimous support and, up until this year, has been renewed by consensus. Russia's actions today have cynically undermined international peace and security, all to advance the corrupt bargain that Moscow has struck with the DPRK. Moscow appears to be intent on facilitating the DPRK's illegal pursuit of weapons of mass destruction, and its veto today was a self-interested effort to bury the panel's reporting on its own collusion with the DPRK to secure weapons that it can use to further its aggression against Ukraine. Russia alone will own the outcome of this veto. A DPRK more emboldened to reckless behavior and destabilizing provocations, as well as reduced prospects for an enduring peace on the Korean Peninsula. Despite today's veto and abstention, all Security Council resolutions and UN measures addressing the DPRK's unlawful WMD and ballistic missile programs remain in effect. We will continue to work to counter the DPRK's unlawful actions, work with like-minded states through all available means to limit the threat posed by the DPRK, and respond to efforts by its enablers to shield the DPRK from responsibility. And with that, John?
Sure, let me follow up on that to begin with. Say Russia alone will own the outcome of the veto. Could you explain a little bit about what you mean by that? Obviously, you're saying that Russia has a self-interest in this, but do you think there are any repercussions? Is there anything that the U.S. Or elsewhere is going to do to enforce the sanctions a bit more?
So the sanctions will continue to be in effect, as I said, but unfortunately, this important panel has not seen its mandate renewed, and we will continue to work to secure information about the DPRK's pursuit of illegal weapons, and we will continue to work to make that information public and make it available to other members of the Security Council. But I think what we've seen as a result of Russia's actions today is a DPRK that's emboldened. It continues to be largely isolated in the world, but we are in a different place than when you had Russia and China voting to uphold accountability for the DPRK. And now you've seen a Russia that has cut this bargain with the DPRK because it's in desperate need of weapons to pursue its aggression against Ukraine. And then you saw today one of the ways that Russia is delivering on its end of the bargain with DPRK, which is trying to undercut what had been up until now unanimous United Nations Security Council actions.
State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller at his news conference at the State Department in Washington. Again, from the Washington Post article, Russia's UN ambassador, Vasily Nebenzia, told the UN Security Council before the vote that Western nations are trying to strangle North Korea and that the sanctions are losing their relevance and detached from reality in preventing the proliferation of nuclear weapons in the country. He accused the panel of experts of increasingly being reduced to playing into the hands of Western approaches, reprinting biased information and analyzing newspaper headlines and poor quality photos. Therefore, he said it's essentially conceding its inability to come up with sober assessments of the status of the sanctions regime. That was from the Washington Post. Story in Al Arabiya, the top U.S. military general, said Thursday that Washington had not provided Israel with all the weapons that it had requested because the U.S. was not willing to at this point. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant was in Washington earlier this week, where he reportedly presented a wish list of weapons capabilities that his country wanted from the U.S. as it continues a months-long campaign of trying to eliminate Hamas. The chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General C.Q. Brown, told reporters that eliminating Hamas would be a challenge for Israel. As for the weapons, one reason Israel was not provided with everything it wanted was that we either don't have the capacity to provide. The other reason was that the U.S. was not willing to provide some of those capabilities, not right now. That was reporting from Al Arabiya. The Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder asked about this at his news conference.
Let's go with Lita Baldor, AP, first.
Hi, thanks, Pat. Today, General Brown said that some of the weapons that Israel has asked for and wants have not been provided by the United States, that they've asked for things that either the U.S. doesn't have the capacity to give or doesn't want to give. Can you add a little any more to that? Like, what types of weapons has the United States not provided to Israel that it wanted? And is it largely due to risk and what's available, or are there other things such as conditioning that on progress in humanitarian efforts that sort of keyed into that?
Yeah, thanks very much, Lita. As you know, we have a very longstanding security relationship with Israel. And certainly after October 7th, we worked very hard to rush security assistance to Israel in support of their efforts to defend themselves against attacks from Hamas and future terrorist attacks. And when it comes to the provision of security assistance to include weapons and weapon systems, obviously I don't want to get ahead of those conversations. Those are always ongoing conversations. But through programs like foreign military finance, foreign military sales, again, it's part of our efforts, longstanding efforts to ensure Israel's qualitative military edge. But to get to your specific question, I don't have any information to provide beyond that. Thank you.
Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder, an Air Force Major General, at the Pentagon News Conference. On that war between Israel and Hamas, the story from Reuters, judges at the International Court of Justice on Thursday unanimously ordered Israel to take all the necessary and effective action to ensure basic food supplies arrive without delay to the Palestinian population in Gaza. The ICJ said the Palestinians in Gaza face worsening conditions of life, and famine and starvation are spreading. That story from Reuters. This is Washington Today. President Joe Biden served with former Senator Joe Lieberman in the Senate for 20 years. Joe Lieberman's family announced that Lieberman had died Wednesday night, saying he had died from complications from a fall, and he was 82 years old. President Biden putting out a statement today that says, in part, Joe believed in a shared purpose of serving something bigger than ourselves. He lived the values of his faith as he worked to repair the wounds of the world. And he did so with his beloved family by his side, his dear Adassa and his wonderful children and grandchildren. Jewish liturgy said, of those who serve the needs of the community faithfully, may God grant them their reward. Our hearts today are with the Lieberman family and with those who love Joe across Connecticut and across our nation, which he served faithfully for so long. Part of the statement from President Biden. Joe Lieberman was in the Senate 1989 through 2013, first as a Democrat, then an independent. He was the Democratic vice presidential nominee in the year 2000. In 2008, he endorsed Republican presidential nominee John McCain. The president spoke to a reporter at Joint Base Andrews as he was boarding Air Force One, very briefly, just saying he was a good man. And then on board, the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre had more.
The president also spoke to Hadassah Lieberman to express his condolences to her and her family's loss. The president and Senator Lieberman served together in the U.S. Senate for 20 years. Senator Lieberman was principled, steadfast, and unafraid to stand up for what he thought was right.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre on Air Force One. In recent years, Joe Lieberman co-chaired the group No Labels, which is currently looking for a candidate to run on a third-party ticket against President Biden and former President Trump in this year's presidential election. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat from Connecticut, spoke to reporters last night when the news came out.
Joe Lieberman was my friend for more than 50 years on the world and national stages. He helped to define and frame an era in our history. Most strikingly about Joe Lieberman is that he was a fighter. He stood up for everyday Americans and people of Connecticut, leaving a legacy of working and fighting for environmental values, civil rights and liberties, consumers, and other great causes of our time. And he was a person of deep love for his family and faith. And really what I most remember about Joe Lieberman is not only that he was a role model and a leader who sought to bridge gaps and bring people together, but he was supremely a kind man who could disagree without being disagreeable, as the saying goes, always listening and trying to bridge gaps and bring people together.
Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat from Connecticut, reflecting last night on the news that former Senator Joe Lieberman has died. In December 2021, Joe Lieberman was on C-SPAN's Washington Journal Morning program talking about his book, The Centrist Solution, How We Made Government Work and Can Make It Work Again.
Centrism is not the same as moderation. Centrism means whether you're left or right or center or Democrat, Republican, or independent, you're willing to come to the center to talk about a problem with people who have different points of view, different parties than you, and you're willing to negotiate and compromise in the national interest to get something done for your country and your constituents. And in this book, I describe a number of cases where I was privileged to be in the middle of that kind of process on balancing the budget, environmental protection, national security, homeland security, after 9/11 and human rights. It can be done, but it hasn't been done lately, and the American people have really suffered as a result.
Why do so many members of Congress consider compromise a bad word? Is there something wrong about how this political system is set up that makes members of Congress less willing to compromise?
Well, you know, in a democracy where people have different points of view, like ours, and there's no central authority, no dictator to say this is the way it's going to be. You only get things done if you sit down and compromise. And compromise, I always say to people, doesn't mean you have to compromise your ethics or your morality. If something that's being proposed you think is just unethical or immoral, don't support it. But most of the time in the legislative setting, and I can tell you that because I was in the Senate for 24 years, the compromises asked are not moral or ethical. They're a question of, do you want 100% of what you want on a given bill? Are you only going to settle for 100%? Are you willing to and get nothing? Are you willing to compromise, which is to say, accept less? And in the great moments of our history, going back to the Constitutional Convention, where they compromised to get this new country of ours going, it's always been that way. In recent times, there have been a lot of pressures going the other way, pressures from political parties, from contributors, from increasingly partisan media that have made members of both parties, liberals and conservatives, less willing to compromise. And therefore, the American people have suffered because their problems have not been responded to or solved, and opportunities for our country have not been seized. And that's what we've got to change for the good of America.
Former Senator Joe Lieberman on C-SPAN's Washington Journal morning program in December 2021. He has died at the age of 82. An article from Connecticut Insider reads, "The political leaders from around Connecticut and the nation are preparing to gather Friday at a historic Stamford synagogue for the funeral of the late Senator Joe Lieberman. Funeral for Lieberman will be held at 10 a.m. Eastern Friday at the congregation Agudath Shalom in Stamford, the city where the senator grew up in a working-class Jewish family. Those leaders include former Vice President Al Gore, U.S. Senators Chris Murphy and Richard Blumenthal, members of the state's congressional delegation, including Rosa DeLauro and Jim Himes, and the Stamford mayor, Caroline Simmons." And also from this article, Connecticut Insider, Governor Ned Lamont, a one-time rival who challenged Lieberman's position on the Iraq War during the 2006 U.S. Senate race, will be there as well. And finally, on Washington Today, this is opening day of the 2024 Major League Baseball season, and in Baltimore, the new owner, David Rubenstein, kicked off at a news conference with Governor Wes Moore and Oriole legend and Hall of Famer Cal Ripken Jr. David Rubenstein is co-founder of the investment firm The Carlyle Group and a philanthropist, and he's been on C-SPAN about 100 times over the years. He's co-chair of the National Book Festival and president of the Economic Club of Washington, interviewing public figures. Today at the news conference, he said he hoped to bring the community together through baseball and win.
When the team first came here in 1954, the purchase price was $2.2 million. My partners and I are paying a little bit more than that, inflation being what it is. But we're proud of every penny we're paying because it's worth every penny we're paying. Because we really have a unique franchise with an incredible group of young players, with the best general manager in baseball, the best manager in baseball, and I hope the best fans in baseball, and also the best government officials supporting a team in baseball. So what I hope to do is to make sure this is not the high water mark. Today is an easy day to say everything is great, and hopefully we'll win opening day. But I don't want this to be the high water mark. I want the high water mark to be in the fall when we go to the World Series and we show that we are a city that supports a great team, and we are a city that is represented by a great team, and we unify the city in ways that only the Orioles can really do. We have other teams and other great institutions in this city, and I've been involved with some of them, like Johns Hopkins. But nothing unifies a city and unifies this city as the Baltimore Orioles and as the success of the Baltimore Orioles. So I hope that we can bring that about, and I look forward to working with everybody in Baltimore who would like to help the Orioles become as great as they once were and as great as we know they can be.
David Rubenstein today in Baltimore. He is the leader of the new ownership group of the Orioles. The price paid, $1.725 billion. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and you'll get the stories making headlines in Washington emailed to you every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.